To every secular state was conceded the right of establishing the religion it acknowledged as supreme and exclusive within its own territories, and of forbidding the open profession of its rival. Subjects were to be free to quit a country where their own religion was not tolerated. The doctrines of Luther for the first time received a positive sanction, and if they were trampled underfoot in Bavaria and Austria, they predominated in Saxony and Thuringia. But the sovereigns alone were to determine what form of religion should prevail within their territories. The feelings of subjects who had no representatives in the Diet were little attended to in the pacification. In the ecclesiastical territories, indeed, where the unreformed religion enjoyed an undisputed supremacy, the free exercise of their religion was obtained for all who had previously embraced the Protestant doctrines. But this indulgence rested only on the personal guarantee of Ferdinand, King of the Romans, by whose endeavors chiefly this peace was effected, a guarantee which, being rejected by the Roman Catholic members of the Diet, and only inserted in the treaty under their protest, could not, of course, have the force of law. If it had been opinions only that thus divided the minds of men, with what indifference would all have regarded the division? But on these opinions depended riches, dignities, and rights, and it was this which so deeply aggravated the evils of division. Of two brothers, as it were, who had hitherto enjoyed a paternal inheritance in common, one now remained, while the other was compelled to leave his father's house, and hence arose the necessity of dividing the patrimony. For this separation, which he could not have foreseen, the father had made no provision. By the beneficent donations of pious ancestors, the riches of the church had been accumulating through 1,000 years, and these benefactors were as much the progenitors of the departing brother as of him who remained. Was the right of inheritance then to be limited to the paternal house, or to be extended to blood? The gifts had been made to the church in communion with Rome, because at that time no other existed, to the firstborn, as it were, because he was as yet the only son. Was then a right of primogeniture to be admitted in the church, as in noble families? Were the pretensions of one party to be favored by a prescription from times when the claims of the other could not have come into existence? Could the Lutherans be justly excluded from these possessions, to which the benevolence of their forefathers had contributed, merely on the ground that, at the date of their foundation, the differences between Lutheranism and Romanism were unknown? Both parties have disputed, and still dispute, with equal plausibility, on these points. Both alike have found it difficult to prove their right. Law can be applied only to conceivable cases, and perhaps spiritual foundations are not among the number of these, and still less were the conditions of the founders generally extended to a system of doctrines. For how is it conceivable that a permanent endowment should be made of opinions left open to change? What law cannot decide is usually determined by might, and such was the case here. The one party held firmly all that could no longer be wrested from it. The other defended what it still possessed. All the bishoprics and abbeys which had been secularized before the peace remained with the Protestants, but by an express clause, the unreformed Catholics provided that none should thereafter be secularized. Every impropriator of an ecclesiastical foundation, who held immediately of the empire, whether elector, bishop, or abbot, forfeited his benefice and dignity the moment he embraced the Protestant belief. He was obliged in that event instantly to resign its emoluments, and the chapter was to proceed to a new election, exactly as if his place had been vacated by death. By this sacred anchor of the ecclesiastical reservation, reservatum ecclesiasticum comma, which makes the temporal existence of a spiritual prince entirely dependent on his fidelity to the olden religion, the Roman Catholic Church in Germany is still held fast, and precarious, indeed, would be its situation were this anchor to give way. The principle of the ecclesiastical reservation was strongly opposed by the Protestants, and though it was at last adopted into the Treaty of Peace, its insertion was qualified with the declaration that parties had come to no final determination on the point. Could it then be more binding on the Protestants than Ferdinand's guarantee in favor of Protestant subjects of ecclesiastical states was upon the Roman Catholics? Thus were two important subjects of dispute left unsettled in the Treaty of Peace, and by them the war was rekindled. Such was the position of things with regard to religious toleration and ecclesiastical property. It was the same with regard to rights and dignities. The existing German system provided only for one church, because one only was in existence when that system was framed. The church had now divided. The Diet had broken into two religious parties. Was the whole system of the empire still exclusively to follow the one? The emperors had hitherto been members of the Romish Church, because till now that religion had no rival. But was it his connection with Rome which constituted a